Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. It has been a massive summer for true crime. And if you're new around here, hi, my name's Georgia. And on this channel, I talk about unsolved true crime. Also history sometimes, mostly unsolved true crime. And every so often, I like to come back on here and tell you about some updates in cases that I've covered in the past. Because our interest in a case shouldn't just disappear as soon as the video is over. Like, there's always more going on. These are true real life stories that are being actively worked on a lot of the time by law enforcement. And there have been steps forward, some identities being found in some massive cases. And I'm here today to tell you all about them. Today I'm going to tell you about what's currently going on in the Long Island serial killer case and the trial or the steps towards trial in that case. I'm going to tell you about some victims or potential victims, I should say, of the Long Island serial killer and their identifications. I'm going to talk about the Bear Brooks murder case. There is a massive one in that the murderer in the yogurt shop murders might have actually finally been identified after over 30 years. So strap in, get comfortable. We're going to be talking about some little rays of light in these horrible, dark investigations. First up, I want to talk about huge movement in the Bear Brooks murder case, one of the most intricate spider webs of a case I've ever covered. I remember researching the story originally took me weeks because I simply couldn't put all the pieces together. I would recommend going to watch the original video that I made on this case because I can't even begin to do the intricacies justice in just a synopsis here. But essentially, a very brief overview of this story. In 1985, a hunter in Bear Brook State Park in Allenstown, New Hampshire, came across a metal 55-gallon drum in which there were the bodies of two people wrapped in plastic, later determined to be an adult female and a young girl. They had both died of blunt force trauma, and their identities, nor that of their killer, could be found at the time. Fast forward 15 years to May 2000, and very nearby to where that first barrel was found, another metal 55-gallon drum was discovered, and the remains of two young girls were found inside this one. Despite the fact that this drum wasn't found in the original investigation back in 1985, it was determined that it had been there for all those years. It was just outside of the original crime scene. It was thought that all these murders were connected, and seeing as it was one adult woman and three children, it was assumed they were all likely biologically related. However, that was not quite the case. In 2019, the adult woman was identified as Marlise Honeychurch, and the oldest and youngest kids were her biological children, Marie Vaughan and Sarah McWaters. However, the middle child, inexplicably, was not biologically related to any of them. Now, it was known at the time of her disappearance slash death, Marlise had been dating a man called Terry Rasmussen, who for a long time, even before these identifications, had been the prime suspect for these murders. Rasmussen was known as the Chameleon Killer due to the fact that he used a number of different aliases over the years whilst he travelled across the USA killing people. It's thought that he was responsible for at least 5 murders, probably many, many more that we don't know of. The murders of Marlise, Marie, Sarah, and this unidentified child were thought to be just 4 of many, many more. Which brings us to that third child. In January 2014, the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit partnered with channel favourite The DNA Doe Project, who were able to produce a new DNA profile for this girl. The profile showed that she was solely of European descent and also gave new and updated lists of DNA matches, which researchers then painstakingly used to build her family tree. In cases like this, we're rarely talking about close DNA connections. We're talking about researchers finding third, fourth, fifth cousins, people many, many generations back. You're trying to build out a family tree with just DNA of people who are so loosely related to you. In Jane Doe's case, they created a tree containing 25,000 people. That's a lot of people to work backwards through. They've essentially got to go through every single person, every single name, and try and find DNA that's just that little bit closer. Eventually, researchers were able to identify a couple born in the 1780s who are likely ancestors of Jane Doe. And from there, they worked through the years, through their descendants, until they found a family who sparked their interest. They found an obituary from 2005 for a great-great-great-granddaughter of that 1780s couple. The obituary stated that this woman was survived by a daughter called Pepper Reed. Pepper was born in 1952 in Houston but disappeared in the 70s, and it just so happened that Terry Rasmussen was known to be living in Houston in the 1970s. This sparked a lot of interest, so they looked into it further and found more matches between Pepper's ancestors and the unidentified girl, and through that they were able to confirm that Pepper had to have been Jane Doe's mother. Now, because Jane Doe was so young, the team kind of went into this expecting that they would likely never be able to find this girl's actual name. They thought that just by finding her mother, finding her extended family, that might have to be enough. It took them 18 months to identify Pepper, but they were surprised to find that as soon as they did find Pepper, they were able to find her daughter, literally within half an hour. They found a birth record for a girl called Rhea Rasmussen, born in Orange County, California in 1976, where Pepper had last been seen. Now, Rasmussen isn't a rare surname, but records show that this girl had a mother with the maiden name of Reed, and this piqued the team's interest. They drove all the way to Orange County to retrieve the birth certificate, which confirmed that Rhea's parents were Terry Rasmussen and Pepper Reed. Almost 5 decades after her death, Rhea Rasmussen was finally identified on the 5th of September 2025. According to surviving family members, Pepper was last seen at Christmas 1975 in Texas, at which point she was pregnant. Family remember the child's father as being Terry Rasmussen. After Christmas, Pepper moved to California and they never saw her again. They never met this child. It's thought that at the time of her death, Rhea was between 2 and 4 years old. Surviving family members have requested to remain anonymous as they try and work through this tragedy. They knew that Pepper had gone missing, but they likely never considered that something as horrific as this would be the outcome. With Rhea being identified, the investigation here is far from over. Pepper has never been found and the investigation into her disappearance remains active. Authorities do believe that she is just another one of Rasmussen's victims, which does make sense. Rasmussen is a fascinating and rare serial killer in that every single one of his victims seems to be somebody who was close to him. He had relationships with all of his victims. And this is very unusual as a pattern because it means it's so much easier to get caught. And he was eventually. In 2002, he was convicted of the murder of his girlfriend, Eunsoon June. He died in prison in 2010, 7 years before DNA profiling connected him to the Bear Brooks crimes. Investigators are still trying to find out any information they can about Rasmussen and his movements, especially between 1974 and 1985 in the states of New Hampshire, California, Arizona, Texas, Oregon, and Virginia. It's thought that he continued killing people in this time and they want to find all of his victims. I couldn't believe it when I heard the news that Rhea had been identified. I know forensic genetic genealogy is this incredible, incredible thing, but I really thought Rhea would be just too young to identify, especially with so few people who would have known her in life. She had a short life. I hope it wasn't a sad life as well, but I can't imagine that Pepper and Terry had a happy home life. And we don't know at what point Pepper died. We don't know how soon after Rhea's birth, Pepper was presumably murdered. We don't know how long she would have been with Marlise. Clearly, at some point, Rasmussen has killed Pepper, travelled from California to New Hampshire with Rhea in tow. There, he's met Marlise, and Marlise may have taken on care of Rhea alongside her own 2 daughters. We can assume that might not have been the case. Maybe Rhea was killed before Marlise, Marie and Sarah, but the fact that their bodies were found so close Suggest probably not. We don't have the answers, but at least now Rhea can be officially laid to rest with her name, with her identity, and that is a huge thing. The second massive update I have for you today is actually from one of the earliest cases I ever covered on this channel, all the way back in April 2018, the case of the 1991 Texas yogurt shop murders. A suspect has been officially named by police 33 years on, after DNA evidence has led them to a significant breakthrough. This case refers to a quadruple homicide that took place at, you guessed it, a yogurt shop in Austin, Texas, named I Can't Believe It's Yogurt. It was Friday, December 6th, 1991, when four teenagers were brutally murdered just after closing time. That's 13-year-old Amy Ayers, 17-year-old Eliza Thomas, 17-year-old Jennifer Harrison, and her 15-year-old sister Sarah. Jennifer and Eliza were employees working the closing shift that night, while Sarah and her friend Amy came by just to get a lift home off of Jennifer. Just before midnight, a passing police officer noticed a fire coming from the shop and called in. Fire services arrived, they put it out, and then they discovered four bodies amongst the debris. It was very clear that the fire wasn't the cause of their deaths. They had all been shot on the head, execution style. They were all nude, gagged, and bound with their own underwear. It was a horrifying crime scene that, as I'm sure you can imagine, sparked a massive investigation. As was likely intended, the fire destroyed nearly all the evidence at the crime scene, bar for one single shell casing that had rolled into a drain, and a trace amount of DNA found underneath Amy's fingernails. There were a number of suspects uncovered in the early days. There were plenty of tips that came in, and two people even went to prison for these murders. However, in 2009, both of their convictions were overturned and they were released from prison after it was found that their DNA did not match the DNA evidence that was found at the scene. Fast forward to now, 2025, and investigators may have finally found out who that crime scene DNA did actually belong to. In late September, Austin police announced a significant breakthrough in this case, thanks to not only new DNA technology, but also new technology around ballistics. In 2022, a new detective called Daniel Jackson was assigned to this case, and he decided to take another look at the ballistics from the shell casings that had been found at the scene. This had been uploaded to the National Integrated Ballistic Information Network several years beforehand, and since then, the database had undergone some major upgrades, so Jackson was now pretty sure that it would be able to tell them some new information, so he ran it again, and this time, there was a hit. There was an unsolved murder in Kentucky with a very similar MO that had the exact same type of bullet casing. Jackson met with the detectives involved in this Kentucky case, and this sparked an idea in him. The DNA evidence from the scene was way too destroyed to be uploaded to CODIS, which is the Combined DNA Index System. But it had been strong enough, thanks to YSTR profiling, to have exonerated the two men back in 2009. Now, YSTR profiling is to do with the Y chromosome. This is passed down from the father, so it means that the Y chromosome in any paternal line is practically identical. You can trace back generations through this one chromosome. So Jackson sent out this old YSTR result to all police departments across the country, asking them to manually compare it to their own databases. And through this, they found another hit. It matched perfectly to a sample from a Greenville, South Carolina murder that had been solved in 2018, thanks to Parable Nanolabs and genealogist C.C. Moore. Moore had used forensic genetic genealogy to pin this crime on a man called Robert Eugene Breschers. Now, he died in 1999 by suicide during a standoff with the police, but up until that point, he had a long criminal history. After his death, it was discovered that he was a serial killer responsible for a number of deaths, and it's thought that there are even more out there that he is yet to be linked to, murders and sexual assaults. Now, this is still a tiny bit dubious because YSTR profiles just aren't as definitive as a full DNA profile, But sadly, we just don't have that in this case. The DNA is too degraded. But Jackson has said that the odds are 2.5 million to 1 that this is Brescia's DNA. And considering that he was already a known killer, that for every moment of his adult life he wasn't in prison, he was known to be committing all sorts of heinous crimes, I would be willing to put down pretty big bets that it was indeed him. He's also been linked to the murder of a mother and daughter in Missouri in 1998 and the sexual assault of a teenage girl in Tallahassee. Just 2 days after the yogurt shop murders, Brescia's was apprehended at the US-Mexico border, about 600 miles from Austin, and it's thought that he may have been going there to dispose of evidence, but obviously they didn't know that at the time when he was apprehended. He was actually arrested on that day after a short car chase, just 2 days after the yogurt shop murders. He was arrested for having a stolen car and felony possession. He was found with a gun that was the same make and model as the one used in the Austin murders. The fact that despite this, he was never linked to the Austin murders is crazy to me, but technology just wasn't as advanced in 1991 as it is now. The communication between forces wouldn't have been as good or easy as it is now. There wouldn't really have been a database to put this information into. So I suppose you just got to accept it for what it was. But it is very frustrating because the information was right there. Especially when you consider the fact that two innocent people actually went to prison for these murders. That is really frustrating. The attention brought on Brescia's name by being linked to this massive, massive case will hopefully mean that people might come forward and link him to other crimes he committed or put him in the area at this time. The pretty much solving of this case has prompted Angie Ayers, Amy Ayers' sister-in-law, to come forward urging the families of victims and victims themselves to upload whatever evidence they have to the national databases. So many cases are being solved nowadays thanks to technological advancements, and I'm so excited to see what massive old case is going to be solved next, because as long as there is DNA evidence in these old cases, they are going to get solved. It is just a ticking time bomb for these criminals. It's just a matter of time. A 2.5 million to 1 chance of it being Brescia's to have committed this crime is a bet that I am quite willing to take. I would place good bets that it is him, because he was a criminal, he was known to do horrific things just like this. He was known to sexually assault, he was known to murder. This was not a good man. I don't know if law enforcement are able to take this and run with it with just the YSTR evidence. I don't know if this case is going to be considered to be officially solved. Maybe they're going to do more DNA profiling, try and link more of the DNA. But it was him. It was essentially him. As far as the evidence suggests currently, it was this guy. Next up, it wouldn't be a case updates episode these days if I didn't tell you about the latest in the Long Island serial killer / Gilgo Beach killer case. Now, there is no massive groundbreaking updates here, just that the accused killer, Rex Heuermann, has had his trial delayed after he was charged with 2 new murders over the summer. The trial was originally meant to be in August, it's now probably going to be early next year. He is continuing to plead not guilty to all 7 charges of murder against him, and his defence have been asking for separate trials for each and every death. However, at the end of September, Judge Timothy Mazzai ruled that it would just be 1 trial for all 7 of the murder charges. Like I said, a trial date hasn't been set yet. There are whispers it will be in early 2026, but nothing is confirmed just yet. Earlier in September, prosecutors said that they are fully ready for this trial. They have turned over all of their evidence to Heuermann's lawyers. They are feeling very confident in their case, it seems. But we've got to remember, it is innocent until proven guilty. He is not yet a convicted serial killer. If this guy is guilty, the fact that he's willingly going through this whole trial, this big publicised trial, does seem crazy to me, but also I don't necessarily think that means much, because a lot of serial killers would love to have a chance to have their crimes platformed in such a way, even if it does mean going to prison for multiple life sentences at the end of it. New York State does not have the death penalty, so that is not on the table here. This guy is just likely, depending on what happens in the trial, going to go to prison for a long, long time. But there is, of course, still chances for him to take a plea deal. But he's seeming to be very insistent that he is pleading not guilty. He might not be guilty, the trial hasn't happened yet. We've just got to wait and see. There has been a bit of back and forth about some of the DNA evidence, which prosecutors say link Heuermann to 6 of the 7 victims. These were rootless hairs linking Heuermann, his daughter and his wife to the bodies found in Long Island on Gilgo Beach. footage. The defense have been trying tirelessly to get this hair evidence excluded because investigators used whole genome sequencing to get it, which is a relatively new technique that's never before been used in a New York criminal trial. But Judge Mazai said that whole genome sequencing is generally accepted in the relevant scientific community, and so he's ruled that this is admissible. And this is pretty big, not just for this case, but for cold cases in New York as a whole, because now it's been allowed once in one trial, it will likely open the door for more cold cases to move forward with prosecution based on this kind of evidence. I wouldn't say necessarily that the hair is the biggest evidence we've got in this case. There is also a lot of technological evidence as well. Laptops, phones, electronics found in humans' house which link him to the murders, which link him to the victims. Apparently there are journal entries or something of that kind in which he writes detailed about the murders and how he committed them and meeting these women. Again, this is all innocent until proven guilty. This is just what the media is saying. So would they probably have a chance of prosecution without the hairs? Probably. But it's good that they've got it. Like, that is very definitive. That links all the victims to Human and potentially to Human's house, because how else would the hairs of his wife and his daughter, who have not been accused of any murders, have gotten the victims otherwise? I am very, very intrigued to see if this trial ends up going ahead. We don't often get to see massive serial killer trials played out in the public like this, because a lot of the time people do tend to take the plea deals, and the fact that he hasn't, it's very interesting to me, so we're just gonna see what happens here. And whilst we're talking about the list, the Gilgo Beach murders, I have to talk about Peaches, one of the suspected victims of this killer. Now, this is a very famous Doe case, and one which has always remained very close to my heart for many years now. Her identity and that of her daughter were always ones which I hoped would eventually be found. So in June 1997, the torso of a woman was found in Lakeview, New York, and thanks to a tattoo of a peach on her left breast, she quickly got the Doe nickname of Peaches. In December 2016, in the period in which a number of Lisk / Gilgo Beach victims were being found, additional skeletal remains were found on Long Island, which were found to be a DNA match to the torso found in Lakeview 19 years earlier, to Peaches. Alongside these remains found on Long Island were those of a child, who was found to be the biological daughter of Peaches. Big movements have been made in the last couple of years towards identifying this pair. I think it's been quite clear for a while that investigators have been on the edge of a name. I think I even said that in my last case updates video, which was in like March. But on April 23rd of this year, 2025, Nassau County Police announced that Peaches had been identified as Tanya Denise Jackson. She was born in October 1970 in Alabama, and she had served in the United States Army from 1993 to 1995. Her daughter was 2-year-old Tatiana Marie Dykes, born on the 17th of March 1995 in Texas, although at the time of their disappearances they were living in Brooklyn. It's thought that Tanya might have been working as a medical assistant at the time, and she was estranged from her family. Sadly, the pair were never reported as missing, and it doesn't seem like anyone necessarily noticed they had gone. Tanya's family did provide DNA samples to help confirm their identities, and local authorities initially turned over DNA evidence to the FBI in 2022, which provided a likely identification. And then they obtained additional DNA samples in 2024, which allowed the police to notify surviving family members before their names were announced this year. So yeah, they have known their names or known... It sounds like they've known potentially that it was Tanya since 2022, they've known for sure since 2024. Investigators have now stated that finding Tanya and Tatiana's identities was just the beginning here. Although their deaths are being looked at in connection with the Gilgo Beach murders, there is also the possibility that they could be unrelated, and they're investigating all avenues here and offering a $25,000 reward for any information leading to an arrest. They're particularly asking for anyone who served in the military with Tanya to come forward. So although Tanya and Tatiana have now been finally identified, we've got a long way to go in their case, and I really hope the police are able to get them justice. The pair were laid to rest, with Tanya receiving full military honours earlier this year. I don't really know what I think in regards to Tanya and Tatiana being linked to the Long Island serial killer, to the Gilgo Beach killer, to potentially Rex Heuermann. This case is very distinct from the rest, I think, in that Tatiana is the only child, in that Tanya's torso was found in Lakeview, New York, 19 years earlier. It doesn't quite fit with the rest. I also couldn't find any evidence, or at least I couldn't find it reported in any of the media that Tanya worked as a sex worker. She might have done, I couldn't find the information. They definitely think that she worked as a medical assistant, so I don't quite know where she fits in here, but again, it's not my job to find that out. It's the investigator's job, and I'm sure they're working on that as we speak. So again, I'm still keeping a very close eye on this. I'm very intrigued to see what comes of it. Many, many years ago, I covered the murder of Faith Hedgepeth, a third-year student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. On the 7th September 2012, a friend walked into Faith's home after there was some concern over having not heard from her in a while, and they found her body on the floor of her bedroom, partially nude, wrapped in a quilt. Faith had spent the night before out at a club with her roommate, Karina Rosario, before returning home, and the last time she was known to be alive, like 100%, was 2:06 a.m. She was captured on CCTV leaving the club. At 3:30 a.m, a text was sent from Faith's phone to an ex-boyfriend of her roommate's called Brandon Edwards, and although this text did come from Faith's phone, there's no evidence that she was the one who definitively sent that text. In September 2021, 9 years after the murder, a 28-year-old man called Miguel Salguero Olivares was arrested on a first-degree murder charge in Faith's case. He was identified finally through DNA found at the scene after he was stopped on a drunk driving charge. Court documents released in 2022 revealed that not only did his DNA match the DNA found at the scene, but his palm print was also found on the murder weapon. Now, it's obviously been over 4 years since his arrest though, and no trial has taken place. In November last year, 2024, it was announced that prosecutors had also added charges of first-degree burglary, rape, and a sexual offence, but still no trial, so why is it taking so long? Well, it kind of seems like the defence are unhappy with the idea that only Salguero Olivares was involved in this case, and they've been looking closely at Faith's roommate, Karina Rosario. In July of this year, motions were filed to look into the possible involvement of Rosario and to ask for more expert witnesses and DNA testing, motions all filed by Salguero Olivares' attorneys. It seems they're trying to mitigate his involvement by potentially implicating others, and it's smart to go for the roommate because there have long been questions surrounding her potential involvement. But very importantly, she's never been arrested, she's never been named as a suspect. This is just what the attorneys are trying to do. So the attorneys filed a motion asking a judge to allow independent testing of a 2-inch-long blood stain that was found on the inside of the bathroom door frame. Rosario had told police that she'd been inside the bathroom that night. Also, on the morning of Faith's death, she had blood on her finger, something which both she and another witness told police. Chapel Hill police have tried to analyse a bathroom bloodstain, which did appear to be a partial palm print and a partial fingerprint, but they didn't have enough evidence for a full analysis. And now the attorneys want all the samples sent for independent DNA testing, obviously in an attempt to try and deflect some of the blame onto somebody else. And maybe they can, I don't know. A former judge did tell the News Observer that the filings for this independent testing could cause problems in this case, maybe it's going to delay it further, but it is going to be a challenge for the attorneys to overcome this overwhelming DNA evidence placing their client at the scene. I mean, you can't really argue with his DNA being found there and his palm print being found on the murder weapon. That's really hard to argue. This case has been going on for so long now that I'm sure at this point Faith's friends and family just want answers. I don't know how much this is going to delay things by, but I really hope it's not that long. Like, to wait this long for a trial, I can imagine, is so painful. This next update is something I am shocked hasn't been splashed all over the front pages of the newspapers, but then again, maybe not all that shocked, considering it's about the Met's incompetence once again in the case of Stephen Lawrence. 18-year-old Stephen was stabbed, murdered in southeast London in 1993, and I can't even begin to explain the ways in which this case was messed up by London's Metropolitan Police. The racism, the cover-ups, the incompetencies, but I'll leave my original video link below if you want to find out. Now, this case led to massive systemic changes, although of course, if you know anything about the Met, you'll know that not much has actually changed. They just
said it has. Within just days of the murder, prime suspects had been identified, but it wasn't until 2012, 19 years later, that two of the men were finally found guilty of this crime. They vehemently denied any involvement for years, but now news has come out in a parole hearing that one of the perpetrators, David Norris, has admitted his involvement on several occasions now, dating all the way back to 2018. But it's only come out now, in a parole hearing in 2025. Even Stephen's mother, Baroness Doreen Lawrence, had no clue, saying this was deeply shocking news to her. And this is massive, because not only has this guy, David Norris, admitted guilt, admitted to punching Stephen, but it also suggests that he knows exactly who else was involved, because we know it was a whole gang of people, but only two of them have ever served any time for it. But he is refusing to share the information, saying that doing so would pose a risk to him and his family. Like, we now know for sure that this guy was at the scene when Stephen was killed. We know he has admitted to punching him. That also suggests that he knows who else was there and he could be a witness and also get those people to go down for it. But he is staying quiet. And despite this massive revelation coming out in 2018, Baroness Lawrence has said that the Met Police stopped investigating Stephen's murder 5 years ago and they've done nothing since, despite so much new information being revealed in that time. It is just wild to me that nothing more is being done like this and it was kept so quiet. Anyway, we're currently waiting on the parole board decision over whether Norris is safe to be released. One psychologist has said that he is not safe to be released from prison, that he is an unreliable narrator of his own life, and also very racially abusive. Another psychologist has said that he is safe for release, so we're waiting on the parole board decision there. I'm very intrigued to see what that will be. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Mysteries and Histories. If you have a bit of time, I would love for you to go and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and spread the word. It would be much appreciated. I'll see you next week.